Spartans, ready your breakfast and eat hearty, for tonight we dine in hell.
Good King Wolfonidas, can I share with you some of these?
What is that?
Kiwi fruit. My wife packed them up for me. They're loaded with nutrition and fiber.
No, it's weird looking.
Our archers have breakfast burritos, which they desire to share with you.
No, I'm not even hungry. I was just saying that breakfast thing. You know, just to say it. Remember this day, Spartans, because the poets will sing of how we 300 warriors fought off the 1,000,000 Persians.
Actually, sire, our scouts are saying it's more like 100,000 of them.
Yeah, but we are definitely outnumbered, so...
Well, somewhat. We just got a whole bunch of reinforcements.
But not as many as them.
No, but when you factor in the terrain, I mean, the terrain really favors us.
Okay, the terrain.
Also, they've got the sun in their eyes.
You know what? You're kind of getting on my last raw nerve here. We are vastly outnumbered. We're going to do this really heroic thing. We're going to them up really badly and then die in the process and be famous forever. End of story.
Actually, I like our chances.
You like our chances? What kind of talk is that?
I can see a win here.
See, this is why I didn't want to bring you. Everybody else, the other 298 Spartans, are totally cool with being outnumbered, getting slaughtered, and going right into the history books, but not you. What is it with you?
I think maybe somebody's a little hangry.
Me?
You get like this if you don't eat. Try the breakfast burrito.
Ugh, it's so heavy, it's just gonna sit in my stomach all day.
Just a few bites.
Can I still say the thing about, you know, tonight we dine in hell?
Maybe more like... Tonight we dine, and they might be out of some of the specials.
This is just not the underdog story I was told it would be. Maybe if I listen to this show about underdogs, I'll understand better. And now he took the Persians and the points over Golden State. Colin McEnroe.
Although, when you take the Persians and the points, it turns out to be spear points. I thought it was just a typical betting line. All right, so, and the Golden State, they're the Warriors. I mean, you know, you're not going to beat them. So, we're going to be talking about underdogs today. Maybe we'll be able to help that obscure Persian king. Although, it turns out to be a really complicated topic. It doesn't really lay itself out as neatly as maybe we thought going into the show. But that makes us happy rather than sad. Joining us right now for an overview, because he covers the waterfront, Mike Pesca is the host of the Slate Daily podcast, The Gist with Mike Pesca, and the sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen. I'll tell you the way to use them. So shorter dog walk, you do The Gist. Long dog walk, like you're circling all around Elizabeth Park, then you go with Hang Up and Listen.
Yes, an underdog walk.
Underdog
keep
walk.
It here.
Exactly. So, but either way, you got to listen one way or another. Joining us in a few minutes is Reggie Hatchett. You want to talk about an underdog story? Well, I mean, Reggie's supposed to be here in the studio with us today. He's the coach of the Weaver High School basketball team, which is an underdog in a lot of ways, and including the fact that he's not here because there's a leak in the roof of the gym and he has to stay there and mop it up so that his team can practice. Lucy Ferris is here in the studio. She's writer in residence at Trinity College, author of many books, including most recently A Sister to Honor. A little bit later, we'll be talking to August Wolf, which is a great name. No relation to Kion. He's the Republican candidate for U.S. Senate, who will probably be the opponent of Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal this year. That would make him an underdog. But so, Mike, I want to just sort of talk about our American psychology about underdogs. You could sort of argue, or I will argue to you anyway, that there are two currents that are kind of in conflict with one another. One of them is our notion of having been foundationally underdogs. We have Puritans fleeing from England. They are absolutely underdogs. They've got to go someplace and start a new life. You've got the story of our revolution, which is we position ourselves, at least narratively, as underdogs against the better organized, better trained British. So you've sort of got that. This is a story of a nation of plucky upstarts. But then you've got also the strain of triumphalism that we're seeing right now in American politics, that you know Donald Trump doesn't think that we're underdogs or that we should be underdogs. He says we're not winning anymore. We're supposed to win all the time. We're supposed to be top dogs, city on the hill, American exceptionalism. So I don't know. It seems as though we have kind of divided ideas about our own dog status.
Yeah, but at the same time, especially Trump supporters are the ones keening to the argument that China is handing us our lunch on trade negotiations and the Mexicans are running circles around us. So we feel like, according to his narrative and the people voting for him, hapless underdogs there too. And even in matters military, when clearly, I mean, the Republicans are actually saying things like, well, we need to have the strongest military, which, you know, Obama rolls his eyes and say, we do, the strongest, stronger than the next six combined even. Well, they still, you know, talk about it in the high noon phrasing where we'll only go to war if we're picked upon and we're reluctant warriors, because people need to think of themselves as underdogs. And I think that's pretty true. Even, you know, maybe during the British Empire, there was some sort of obligation to it and you thought of yourself differently. But I think especially Americans, and it's probably true with a lot of types of people, that it helps to think of themselves as underdog and pressed into service and, you know, trying to overcome odds, because that is the more noble thing.
Although, and I think for Americans, it's hard to, I mean, one underdog story that Americans are very unlikely to tell when they sit around telling underdog stories would be the story of North Vietnam, which, you know, arguably is one of the amazing amazing military underdog stories of all time, with, you know, the most powerful nation in the world paired up with the South Vietnamese and ultimately the U.S. leaving. But that's so not what our myth is, right? Our myth is a little bit more like the 2003 invasion of Iraq. We just roll in and everybody kind of gives up.
Well, this is cruel, but, you know, the Al-Qaeda attacks were was an underdog story, an evil underdog story. But what's the phrase asymmetrical warfare mean except underdogs versus the those in power? And in the asymmetry of it, the United States is the one with those in power. And this also goes into the sports world, when America clearly isn't the plucky underdog, as when a few years ago the United States women's soccer team, the World Cup before this one, lost to South Korea. It did take a couple people to point out, you know, if this were the Hollywood movie, it would be about the South Koreans. They were the Japanese. They were the plucky underdogs.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit more about the political scene at the moment. And so you've been treating of Bernie Sanders lately on your show. I mean, Sanders and Trump, they're often kind of grouped together as these candidates who are harnessing anger. But on this score, I think they're very different. I mean, yeah, Trump may be suggesting, as you say, that we are temporarily an underdog vis-a-vis China or somebody else. But he's basically marketing that exceptionalism and that triumphalism. Whereas Bernie Sanders seems to be saying, A, I'm an underdog, and B, you guys are underdogs too, and this country should exist for underdogs.
But it's working for Trump and not working for Sanders, which gets to the truth of the underdogs. They usually lose.
Right, exactly. So as one of our producers, Jonathan McNichol, said, you know, the reality in sports is, I mean, you'll watch a sports movie about underdogs. All of the great sports movies are about underdogs. You're less likely to pick out a sports contest to watch on television if one of the teams is a real, real underdog, because, in fact, you feel as though you already know the outcome.
Yeah, but when they keep it close, that's when people call each other. Or it's so helpful during the NCAA tournament, which is all about underdogs, when most of us don't even know anything about basketball beyond one or two teams, but they have the numbers next to the teams, and you could see if a 15 seed is threatening a 2. That's all that matters. And every once in a while, there are teams with so many better resources who are sometimes ranked lower, even from the bigger conferences. Yet that still seems like the underdog story, the upset. And psychologists have studied this, and they, knowing nothing, people will pick rooting for the underdog something like 81% of the time.
But I think also, one of the things, and when we get to Lucy's part of the show, I think we're going to talk about sort of the notion of going from underdog to corruption, which is, I think, happens a lot in literature, in fiction. But, you know, and I think you can see it a little bit in sports, too. I mean, I grew up in the New England area. I was a Red Sox fan. I actually, my first season as a baseball fan was the so-called impossible dream year when they did go to the World Series against all odds with a, you know, really long shot, kind of terrible looking team. But for the most part, it was a whole underdog mentality. And then came 2004, and then came this string of victories and this notion of Red Sox Nation, which Charlie Pierce had written about. I mean, it really started in the 1980s, that term. And Charlie Pierce writing about it said it almost had something to do with sort of the, once again, those Puritan origins, that notion that mankind was fallen, that mankind was hitting with a two-strike count all the time. Well, so were the Red Sox. Well, then suddenly there was this, I mean, suddenly everybody, like within a very short time, everybody hated the Red Sox and everybody hated Red Sox Nation. They were every bit as obnoxious as the Yankees, if not more so.
Yeah, I have a theory about the narratives we create with underdogs, because especially perennial losers in professional sports. And my theory as it relates to the Red Sox, that they embody Puritanism, as per Charlie's framing, or whatever, you know, the Cubs have their own version. The Cleveland Browns would be the rock-solid values of the industrial Midwest. I just think the Red Sox happen to have a lot better scribes, writers, and thinkers in the fan base. So they spin out a story of what it means and what it really really means is for a long time they had pretty racist owners and they didn't integrate as well as the rest, and then they got a lot of bad luck, you know, and some teams have got to lose at some point. But the whole thing about underdogs, don't you think it's 90% narrative? I mean, most of why we like them is a concoction on the part of the viewer or the listener or the guy who casually tunes into the NCAA tournament. It doesn't have a lot to do with reality.
Well, I think there's a chicken and egg question here. I mean, I grant your point that for the Red Sox, it's kind of, we've got Updike, who's your writer? But but there's also, there's a chicken and egg question, which is, do you learn poetry? Do you learn a poetry about your team because your team sucks so much? You know, if you're used to defeat, if you're used to frustration, if you're used to the egg, the perfect egg being having this huge crack, this fault line running through it, maybe you get more creative. Maybe that's why Scott Simon can wax so poetic about his poor, embattled Cubs, because what else is there to do about the Cubs but develop a certain poetic temperament about them?
Yes, this is like saying, this is like the third man theory of Switzerland with all its peace and all its prosperity. And they invented the cuckoo clock, right, as Orson Welles said, whereas Italy has never had anything but tumult. And look at it, all they've given the world. So, yeah, it's probably true. You know, tough times lead to great art. But still, you want to be the fan of the 27 World Series winning Yankees if all you care about is backing the winner. I also do find that teams that are not even empirically as bad as some of the ones we're talking about, they concoct that narrative too. You know, I'm a Jets fan, and the Jets aren't very good, but you could create a few ways of looking at the Jets that aren't that terrible. Unlike a lot of teams, they have won a Super Bowl. Okay, not in my lifetime, and they've never gotten to one. But they were supposedly very bad and same old Jets at a point when they had made the playoffs 3 out of 4 times and had winning seasons. So a lot of fans, you know, sometimes we don't even know that fan bases have this conception of, oh yeah, everyone knows we're the biggest losers. Really? Everyone knows that about the Atlanta Falcons? I didn't know everyone knew that about the Atlanta Falcons. But yeah, I would say about a third of the teams have that. A third of the teams really think that, you know, I would say the Cowboys, the Steelers, the Packers, they all think, well, obviously we're the class of the league. And then the other third are like, you know, maybe if we get a good quarterback, we'll give it a shot this year.
So, narrative, you're right. Narrative is really important. And sometimes the narrative we concoct and that we embrace is really kind of peculiar. For example, if you think of sort of two of the great underdog sports movies are the first ever Rocky movie and Hoosiers. And in each of them, you have a white athlete coming up against this all-powerful black athlete or black team, which is the exact opposite of the, you know, the true American narrative. You know, I mean, the notion that somehow or other African-American athletes in anywhere in the 20th century represent top dogs, overdogs, prohibitive favorites, you know, people who enjoy this enormous advantage over Rocky Balboa and Jimmy, whatever his name is, in Hoosiers. I mean, it seems like something maybe we made up, I don't know, because of white anxiety.
Yeah, well, Jimmy Chitwood. And that's why we
plucked their I knew you'd know that.
Picket fence, don't get lost. Don't get caught watching the paint dry.
Yeah.
By the way, in college, I watched Hoosiers, and in that final scene, every time the score changes, it correlates to an actual shot that you see. Sometimes there's a montage of balls going in. That is my favorite sports movie of all time. And it's based on the real team and Bobby Plump, who still has Bobby Plump's last shot. But why did they pick that story? Just like, why did Stallone base it loosely on Chuck Wepner? And there's a new movie about the real Bayonne Bleeder coming out. Exactly cause of that, because especially in the area of sports, there is this white anxiety, and it's not surprising that Rocky gets nominated and wins the Academy Award. And Creed, which is the much more honest story about a black boxer, and in that movie, he doesn't get nominated, and his opponent is at least foreign, let's say. So it still has to be the plucky underdog minority, the minority in this case being an American.
Yeah, Lucy, what did you want to say?
I was just going to say that I think there's a lot to do with purity in at least these sports underdogs. I mean, think about Lance Armstrong, whose story was all about his, you know, coming back from cancer, you know, which sort of made him the main underdog and the one everybody's rooting for. And then you find out that he's been pumping himself with steroids. And suddenly, it doesn't matter whether he won or he lost or what his struggle was or anything. The purity's gone, and so the fans are gone.
Well, yeah, and of course, within the world of cycling, could sort of, as a sport, argue for being underdogs too. Most of the people who compete in it come from relatively modest backgrounds, and it's dangerous, and people get hurt a lot, and yeah. But Lance, maybe we'll come to that in the second segment. Talk about sort of what happens with corruption. It happens maybe to ultimately everybody who transcends that status. I'm going to bring Reggie Hatchett into the conversation, but to do that. Mike Pesca, I'll let you describe for just a second the most iconic scene in Hoosiers, which you know so well. So what is the most iconic scene in Hoosiers? Surely there can't be a debate about that.
The most iconic scene, I think, is when Coach Norman Dell goes to what we now know as Hinkle Fieldhouse and measures the hoops. Is that what the one you're
yes.
thinking of?
Yes.
Yeah, and he measures the hoops, and Ollie gets on his teammate's shoulder. Strap, I believe, is the big guy. Mm-hmm. And, hey, look at this. It's 10 feet high, just like our gym in Hickory. And look at the foul line. It's 15 feet away, just like our gym in Hickory. Gentlemen, This is his long-winded version of we put our pants on one right. leg at a time. But it worked for the Hoosiers.
Well, let me bring Reggie Hatchett into that conversation. Reggie Hatchett is an amazing basketball coach, and talk about a Cinderella story. Talk about a bunch of athletes who don't have a lot of advantages. He led Weaver High School to the Class M championship here in Connecticut last year. But if Reggie Hatchett did that right now, if he took his team to a gym where they were going to play and then measured off the gym and said, you see, guys, it's exactly the same size as the basketball court we have back home where we practice every day. Reggie Hatchett, that wouldn't exactly be the case right now, would it?
No, I don't think it would have the same effect that it had on the team and the Hoosiers. not modern day. But I think that, you know, the reason why people get behind, you know, a team like ours is not necessarily that we have lesser talent or we seem to be the smaller team, but I think that it's quite obvious that we have a lack of resources when compared to the guys that we face. And I think that, you know, in America, I think the average guy or the average fan can relate to not having adequate resources. And so they kind of get behind, you know, the team that they kind of feel like represents their own status.
Well, I mean, and just to put a finer point on it, aren't you these days, Reggie, practicing in a gym that's where the basketball court is like 70 feet long or something?
Yeah, we had a gym that's kind of like it's a gym at a school, at a culinary school, so it wasn't built to be a full size high school gym or anything like that. So yeah, that's the gym that we've had to practice at. As a matter of fact, whenever it rains, we don't get a chance to practice because the building leaks. So, you know, we won't practice. Our tournament, the state tournament starts today, and we'll have a problem, you know, practicing today because, you know, it'll be raining inside, so to speak.
So there you go, Mike Pesca. This is a guy who can't do that, at least not the length of the court, not for fast breaks, not for things like that. If he measures the new court, it's going to be all wrong.
But at least it helps with the away games because it'll be dry. The kids are looking forward to that.
Right. Well, the biggest adjustment is that, you know, when we work on defenses and things like that, when we play on a regular size court, there's more ground to cover. So there's always an adjustment that they have to make. You know, you can't really make it for them. They have to see it and experience it themselves when they, you know, get on a regular size court. So it is a disadvantage to us to not have a full size court because when we play in the actual games, you know, the spacing has to be adjusted, to spread out more, so to speak.
So, Reggie, your players do not have the kinds of backgrounds that maybe some of the players you play against have in terms of economic resources. I've seen things where your team is on GoFundMe or some other Kickstarter type site trying to raise money for like letter jackets, you know, so that the team can have letter jackets. So, what do you say to them to motivate them? I've seen at least quotes from you, speeches where you've evoked the civil rights era, evoked struggles of the past as a way of motivating your kids to do better against players who maybe do have a different set of resources than an inner city team like Weaver would have.
Right. Well, I definitely use the fact that that they come from these areas where, you know, resources are so scarce, and you know, instead of using that to anger them and make them bitter, I try to turn that into fuel for them to to use their sport as a way to equalize, you know, the situation. Because for a lot of the guys on our team, you know, the only way they're going to go to higher education is if they get an athletic scholarship. Because not only are they come from impoverished areas, they also come from schools that aren't, you know, respected as much as, you know, the suburban schools. So even their grades are questioned by some of the higher learning institutions, whether or not they can do the same work that they, you know, they do in the suburbs. So a lot of times, academic scholarships are few and far in between from, you know, kids that come from failing schools, so to speak, as well. So, it, you know, like a lot of them don't have any opportunity other than athletics to level the playing field, so to speak.
So, Mike Pesca, I know you have to go, but let me just ask you one last question, and you may have your own set of reactions to this. But, you know, one of the ways that sports plays into our foundational methodology is kind of the way that Reggie just said this, that you may not have everything that everybody else has, but if you've got some God-given talent and you work really hard, you exploit it any way you can, or maybe you don't even have that much talent. You know, there are plenty of sports movies about that, but you work hard, that it can be an equalizer. There's a way in which you, the underdog, can put yourself up at a different level. Although I wonder if there's not something kind of seductive and proportionally misleading about that.
Well, I think it maybe works for basketball because it's a sport where five players play at once, and the resources, even with Reggie's gym, you could still get by. It doesn't work for football. It definitely doesn't work for baseball. And it doesn't work for society. So even if sports is a microcosm, let's not kid ourselves, as we so often have, that if you just try hard and have a little pluck, you'll be able to equalize the playing field. And also, when a lot of these kids from an impoverished background get wooed to go to a college, if they're lucky enough to get that offer, man, are they going to be attracted to the huge school with the great facilities, so they don't have to continually be the underdog, as well they should.
Yeah. And so, well, first of all, thank you, Mike Pesca. I know you've got to go. You've got your own show to do. People should listen to The Gist with Mike Pesca. And Reggie, as we finish up this conversation, I think Mike makes a really great point, which is that obviously for a lot of your players, the dream is to go to some place that has multi-million dollar athletic facilities, that where they'll get a lot of the things that elite athletes get. And I know from conversations that you and I have previously had that that's one of your struggles with them, that you have to get them to realize that, yes, they're underdogs now, and they may dream of living a life that's a very different one, but they have to be careful about that, too. They can't let that go to their head or persuade them that that in and of itself is a solution to their problems.
Well, and no doubt, and what the young man just described is very true, and that it's definitely misleading to believe or to allow them to believe that if they just try hard, that, you know, there's some great oasis that they'll, you know, that they'll reach at the end of their high school careers. But I do know that it does happen few and far in between. And the dream that you have to sell to them is that, why not you? How come it can't be you, the one out of 100 that actually makes it, or the one out of 1,000 that actually makes it? And to have 15 guys all believe that they could be the one, then they're going to raise their level. And I, you know, I think that's the challenge that we have as coaches, especially in the inner city, is to make each kid feel like if they give their all, they at least put themselves in position to be in that one guy that, you know, has the, you know, the riches fall upon, so to speak.
All right. Reggie Hatchett, coach of the Weaver high school basketball team. Go Weaver. We're going to take a break. Lucy Ferris and I are going to come back and talk about the underdog motif as it plays out in literature and culture.
But there's a strange satisfaction when you're putting all your action on the underdog. On the underdog. Even though you know the odds may never go your way.
All right, we're back. We're talking about the notion of the underdog. You may feel free to tweet at us with your underdog insights at WNPR Colin. That's at WNPR Colin on the Twitter. Lucy Ferris in studio with me, writer in residence at Trinity College, author of many books, most recently A Sister to Honor. So before we jump in, Lucy, we asked our friend Peter Sokolowski up at Merriam-Webster to help us out a little bit. What is this word, this term we're using, what does it even mean, at least lexicographically?
Merriam-Webster's Collegiate Dictionary, 11th edition. Underdog, noun. Sense 1, a loser or predicted loser in a struggle or contest. Sense 2, a victim of injustice or persecution. Date of first use, 1859.
All right, so, Lucy, you know, there's that whole idea that there are only seven stories that we keep telling over and over again. We actually did a whole show trying to figure out what those seven stories are. Who knows? But one of them probably is some version of Cinderella, right?
Right.
That particularly 19th century fiction, 18th century fiction, there's an awful lot of that. That Jane Eyre is Cinderella. That there's this story that the last shall be first, and you think you're ugly and downtrodden and threadbare and you don't have any money or connections, but you're wrong.
The meek shall inherit the earth.
Right.
Right.
And so is that just a seductive imprint, you know, that we just want to keep hearing that story over and over again?
Well, it's a morality tale, mm-hmm. right? I mean, it's supposed to keep us on the straight and narrow since there are so many opportunities to cheat. So if you believe that by staying on the straight and narrow that all those cheaters are going to lose in the end and that the tortoise will beat the hare— then you stay on the straight and narrow. I mean, it keeps you in line as a way of kind of enforcing those norms. So it's not just something we want to believe in. I think it's also something that keeps us acting maybe a little more ethically.
Yeah, I mean, ethically, maybe. You'd hate to think that it's an agent of social control. I mean, certainly Dickens loves underdogs, and he doesn't want us to not be outraged by the behavior of the overdogs.
Right, right. Absolutely. And Dickens is great in that he's nuanced. I mean, Fagin in Oliver Twist is a terrible, terrible man. But in some ways, you like him because he is an underdog, because his little army of pickpockets are all poor boys, you know, and because he was born poor and was a pickpocket. So you cut him a little bit of slack until he goes over the edge.
It seems to me that in those 19th and 18th century novels, for the most part, I'm sure we could think of some exceptions, but for the most part, running right up to and including the really seminal, iconic works of Mark Twain, that the notion is that we just want to see the underdog get through this and maybe escape his or her station and arrive at a better place, right? We don't, for the most part, deal with the potential that they are going to become the thing that they abhorred.
Well, even if they are, we generally end the story right before that. I mean, when you think of the story of David and Goliath, you just think about David hitting Goliath, you know, between the eyes with the stone.
We do follow David a little bit. So.
Well, I was going to say, but you don't think about what happens to David and what he does to Bathsheba's husband.
Right.
I mean, that's like a different story. That's a different David.
Right.
We're not thinking about him as the same guy. So it's kind of like romance stories end with the wedding. Underdog stories end with that triumph because we don't want to see past that.
Although I would suggest, and tell me what you think of this, that as we get into the American 20th century, there's a different narrative that pops up. And in about the 15 years between 1925 and 1940, we get two of our really iconic stories. One of them is The Great Gatsby. The other one's Citizen Kane. And in some ways, they're the same story. These are stories about underdogs who made it, who acquired wealth anyway. But in fact, there turned out to be all kinds of other missing things that maybe as we saw our own nation acquire this hegemonic power, it occurred to certain writers and creators like Wells and like Fitzgerald, wow, maybe that's not all there is.
Well, and there's the morality tale again. I mean, Gatsby has to die because Gatsby cheated his way to the top. Mm. I mean, if Gatsby had just been a Horatio Alger character, it would have been harder and I would say far more tragic to kill him off. I mean, when Gatsby dies, we just feel like, well, of course he's going to die.
Mm.
Because there was that corruption that came along with winning his way to the top.
Right. But I think that becomes a more interesting story, that the Horatio Alger story seems naive, you know, much past 1925. That's a harder story to tell. Somebody poor pulls himself up by his bootstraps. Isn't that great? Nobody really buys that anymore. Maybe because we're going through the Depression. We're going through a whole series of things that suggest to us that this is a much more perilous journey from underdog status to top dog status.
Well, and that goes back, though, long before. My favorite underdog story is Becky Sharp in Vanity Fair. In Thackeray's Vanity Fair, who's born with nothing except her wit.
Mm-hmm.
And she uses that wit to claw her way to the top. And you love her every bit of the way. And then, of course, she gets to the top and she has to fall.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. So we've been seeing the germs of that even before we got to Fitzgerald and Wells. Though I would say that again, a lot of those stories, if they go over the edge, are just giving us what the inevitable consequence is.
We're talking to Lucy Ferris right now. We're talking about underdogs. You can tweet at us at WNPR Colin. So let's talk about writers, because one of the things that writers are doing, obviously, is projecting either their dreams, their hopes, their fears. And I think writers often are themselves underdogs.
We all think we're underdogs. I mean, I don't know how Fitzgerald thought of himself, though he had to go out to Hollywood and write screenplays to keep it going. But I'd say that you become a writer because you're unpopular in high school and you have nothing to do on Friday night, so you stay home and write stories. So writers, generally speaking, as a breed, I think, identify with underdogs.
So, and then you can do sort of two things. I mean, if you're going to play into this myth or this narrative at all, and so I'm going to talk about a part of quote-unquote literature that probably you're less familiar with, but the two guys who created Superman,
sure,
Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, they were underdogs. They were nerds. They were, in a lot of ways, you know, in the Cleveland where they grew up, they would have been way down the food chain in high school and other kinds of pecking orders. So they dreamed about somebody who wasn't.
Well, yeah, but their dream also includes Clark Kent.
Right.
So, I mean, Clark Kent is the nebbishy guy, and Superman is his alter ego.
Yes. On the other hand, bear in mind that the one of the many differences between Batman and Superman is that Superman is the reality, Clark Kent is the disguise.
True.
Whereas
True.
Batman is the disguise, Bruce Wayne is the reality.
Yeah, but when Clark Kent is feeling rejected by Lois Lane, he's still really feeling rejected.
Yeah,
you know.
So you can't write that part. You can't write the underdog part out entirely. Somehow or other, all of us, because probably all of us at some level think that we're underdogs, except for Donald Trump and a handful of other people, we want that to latch onto.
Well, I think if we don't think that we're underdogs, then we're probably thinking of our, you know, feeling as though we own the world and we're megalomaniacs. It's true, though, that that's a deceptive myth. I mean, you were talking before about political supporters, and there are plenty of people in this country who think of themselves as beleaguered, as thinking themselves that they're threatened in Iowa by an army of jihadists, and have trouble accepting that this is a relatively affluent country that is a lot stronger than all the other countries in the world. We're not comfortable with that. So we adopt that persona, maybe the way Superman adopts Clark Kent.
Or, I mean, in fact, politically, Marco Rubio's supporters right now are running, I think, where they're comparing him to Harry Potter and Donald Trump to Voldemort. But Harry Potter is an interesting question, because Harry Potter is momentarily positioned as an underdog. When we first meet him in the first book, he's living under the stairs. You know, he's an orphan being cared for by his aunt and uncle, who don't really like him that much. I mean, he's really your quintessential Dickensian orphan in a hostile environment, except that it doesn't stay plausible for maybe more than 100 pages, you start to realize that he's fabulously wealthy. He's got all this inherited money that's all stored up in some weird, you know, magical bank. He's the anointed one. He's got the
mark. He's a wizard.
He's a wizard. And as wizards go, he's an anointed one, too. But there's, once again, there's kind of that fiction almost. It's the American fiction that you're talking about right now. An underdog who really kind of isn't.
Right. And we have plenty of those in literature. We have, you know, incredibly gorgeous women. I mean, the thing about Cinderella is she's very beautiful. Mm-hmm. And that, in traditional stories about women, is it gives her an enormous amount of power. But almost all, you know, take the Little Mermaid, all of these beleaguered women have beauty on their side. What better weapon is that?
And I do wonder also, I mean, there's a difference between how we use our fictions and how we use our realities. So, you know, within the world of fiction, there is something very attractive about that story, about the underdog story, rooting for the underdog and hoping, because the author has this under his or her control, that something very nice can be done for the underdog, that by the end of it, you know, Nicholas Nickleby and some of the people around him will come out okay, and some of the really bad and more powerful people will fall. But, you know, in real life, I wonder how much we're willing to do that. You know, it does depend. I mean, for example, when I used to talk to women of a certain generation who were big fans of the UConn women's basketball team, well, I mean, they had never really experienced the typical sports. You know, you win some, you lose some, you have some losing seasons. Yeah, and they weren't interested in having that happen either.
No, we want them to win and win all the time. But, you know, a lot of these stories we think of with underdogs, we don't even think about the fact that they don't win. I mean, think about Thelma and Louise. I mean, they're a pair of underdogs. Mm-hmm. The last shot of them is driving a car into the Grand Canyon.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
they're
about to die. So Holden Caulfield ends up in a mental institution. But we think of them as triumphant because in some ways their spirit lives on or something of that sort, so that we salvage the loss of the underdog by remembering all that we thought was great about them.
Well, the other thing that we expect certain underdogs to do, including the underdogs you just talked about, is speak truth to power. Now, there's ways in which you can speak truth to power. You can blow up somebody's oil tanker by shooting at it, or you can be like Holden Caulfield, just constantly challenging every single shibboleth or settled truth in his world. And that really only an underdog can do this, because it's only meaningful coming from an underdog. Listening to somebody really powerful speak truth to power doesn't have quite the same impact, does it?
Right, right. And we also know that they have, in some ways, nothing to lose. They're already down, so they might as well give that a shot. Again, it's either that or cheating.
Right. But I also think in real life, we could love some of these movies and some of these books about underdogs, but not that many people... Bernie Sanders followers and supporters notwithstanding, it's an interesting story. It's one of the reasons we decided we wanted to do this show. I mean, you know, when Mike Gravel was running, I thought Mike Gravel had some really interesting points about the Iraq War. But people weren't going to sign up for him because they weren't that interested in an underdog. They weren't going to make campaign donations to him. They weren't going to mortgage their time to him, because when it really comes down to it, there aren't that many places in real life where we're willing to risk our time and our energy for long odds or a losing cause.
And there has to be a narrative. I mean, Martin O'Malley also didn't have a sufficiently robust narrative for us to kind of hook onto. We have to sort of come into it in the stream of the narrative and say, yeah, this is, I felt as though I had that past to, you know, my parents were mean to me or whatever it was. And so we can appreciate the story, not just the status.
Yeah. Also, politicians have to tell us two stories at once, much of the time anyway. In some ways, they do want to tell us, hey, I'm the underdog here. I'm the guy who's trying to take on the moneyed interest. I'm the guy who's trying to speak truth to power. But out of the other side of their mouth, they have to say, I could win. I can absolutely win. I'm completely viable. Do not imagine for a second that I can't raise money, that I can't get to the convention, that I can't win.
Jimmy Carter has become a much more popular guy ever since he lost his bid for re-election.
Although Jimmy Carter would be an example of somebody who was an underdog from the get-go. When he ran in 76, he, like Clinton his first time around, these were guys who could plausibly say, I'm an underdog. I don't have the same background as a lot of these kinds of people. I don't have the same kind of national profile as, you know, I mean, Jimmy Carter ran as a simple peanut farmer from Plains, Georgia. You know, my name is Jimmy Carter and I'm running for president. I mean, there was this kind of idea. I'm this pretty kind of average guy, which wasn't entirely true. And I think I could do this job pretty well.
Right. And then the other thing we say about our presidents is we want to go out and have a beer with them, not that we want them to be the smartest guy in the country.
Right. Although, and once again, we have, you know, I think we're schizoid a little bit about that. We, you know, a lot of times we watch these movies like Dave, where some pretty average guy somehow either becomes president, or, you know, or Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, or somebody without pretense, artifice, somebody who's not a political professional who's, you know, overprepared and super handled and backed by all kinds of moneyed interests, you know, comes and really speaks the truth and restores the American dream. Except that those kinds of people tend not to be who we're really attracted to politically.
No, because we do want them in the end to govern. The other thing, though, is that just to circle back to literature, mm-hmm. we'll tell the story of the underdog in a way that even if we know the character is fairly complicated and has some venality or some greed or some whatever, we're going to tell the story highlighting the thing that sort of shines forth. So I think of these Hilary Mantel novels, mm-hmm. Bring Up the Bodies, and Wolf Hall, that have gotten so much attention. It's about Thomas Cromwell, who was an advisor to Henry VIII. Mm-hmm. Now, Thomas Cromwell was a really crafty politician, and he did some pretty nasty things in his life. But the way that he's cast in the novels and in the TV adaptation is of someone who's got a kind of modern sensibility, who understands the truth, who cuts through the BS. And those are qualities that we value, too.
And he's absolutely from the wrong side of the tracks. He grows up in something pretty close to dire poverty and the object of terrible violence from a drunken, abusive father. This is the least likely man to rise up and become a key advisor to Henry VIII. Henry VIII's advisors are courtiers. So at that level, Thomas he's an outlier, and he is an underdog who arrives right into the inner circle.
Right, and he gets where he gets by his wits. We do appreciate people who get places by their wits. We don't like them to show it off, but we like it when we see them using their God-given brains.
Right, and because the other narrative that we have is the narrative of Henry VIII, and we see it over and over again. I mean, sometimes it's an underdog, too. You know, Rocky, at a certain point, becomes this kind of bloated guy with this really sort of ugly, modern, Italianate mansion. You know, he's sort of turned into, you know, the kind of bejeweled and degraded, or at least degenerate, athlete that he probably, you know, would have looked down on from the beginning. We see that happening over and over again. And there's that notion with Henry VIII that, you know, at a certain point, or think about it even in history, with the Roman Empire reaches a point where everybody's kind of inbred, nobody's thinking very clearly. The Visigoths, you know, who are hairy and outdoors, they can pick you off so easily because you've really stopped using your wits. In fact, you've stopped rewarding people for their wits and started rewarding them for their birth.
Though, of course, if we find out that, for instance, the latest evidence on Henry VIII is that he suffers from the same thing Rocky would have suffered
CTE.
From CTE.
Yeah.
So there went his wits. He got knocked in the head.
That could be the threat. All right, Lucy Ferris, great to talk to you. Everything's about Wolf today. Kyone Wolf, Wolf Hall, coming up, August Wolf, the guy who's running against Dick Blumenthal.
Speaking of underdogs, I have a question about that new Batman versus Superman movie. What's Batman supposed to do to Superman? Tell on him? Sue him? Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, Kyone Wolf. Our interns are Tiana Duquette and Benjamin Esty. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. The part of Bill Curry was played by Russell Crowe. For show pages, articles, and videos of the plucky little staff of Here and Now taking on those giants at... Wait, who would they take on? Prairie Home Companion? Go to our website, wnpr.org/Colin. On tomorrow's show, what are critics for? And now, back to Colin.
All right, we're doing a show about underdogs, the mentality of the underdog, the psychology of embracing the underdog. Of course, we're doing it from Hartford, Connecticut, one of the ultimate underdog cities in lots of different ways. And certainly those of us trying to do media in Hartford, Connecticut feel a lot of times like we're underdogs, but in a good way. It means every victory counts so much more, which is one of the realities of underdog life. Joining us now is August Wolf. He is an Olympian and a Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate, the probable opponent of Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal in this year, 2016. So first of all, welcome to our airwaves.
Thank you, Colin. I'm delighted to be on.
So you've made a decision to do something which I think I would assume that you would concede, is going to be fairly difficult, which is run against an incumbent senator in a state where the math favors not only incumbents, as it always does, but his party in particular. U.S. senators from Connecticut have proven very, very difficult to get out of office in the past. So and you have a nice life, from what I can tell, reading about you. Why do something like this?
Well, first of all, I'm extremely concerned about the direction of our country. And then on a personal basis, as you've said, I'm an Olympian, and I got extremely close to getting a medal in 1984. I was 3 centimeters away, I think. So I think this is my opportunity to not only serve the nation and the state of Connecticut, but also to get up and fight for America every day on the Senate floor. Like, I believe we don't have that kind of leadership now in Washington.
But okay, let me just, I'm going to sort of play a little role playing here, but it's not really that much role playing for me. So but you'll probably lose, right? I mean, this is a really, really difficult thing to do. There might be some other ways how you could serve, you could affect change that would be easier. It seems to me running against a guy like Dick Blumenthal, who was undefeatable when he ran statewide as attorney general year after year and now has had some time to settle in as a U.S. senator, you're really hitting off the back tees. You've got a two-strike count on you. So once again, what's your psychology? That's what I'm really asking.
Well, first of all, the climate is extremely different now than it was in the past. You know, we have a very unhappy electorate here in the state of Connecticut. The poll data shows that. Dick Blumenthal, in my book, is a textbook career politician, the kind of person who has driven this state and our country in the wrong direction for several decades. And I think as I go out in the field, I meet Democrats, I meet Republicans, I meet independents, and the great majority of the people are very unhappy with the situation here in Connecticut, and I think they're going to find out that they can express themselves on November 8th, 2016, by voting for me.
Let me ask you about your sports career. So you just said you missed by 3 centimeters in the Olympics, but were you kind of an underdog? I mean, you were a shot putter, and I don't know whether – I mean, there must be within the world of shot putters, you know, the equivalent of any given time – at any given time of the New England Patriots or the New York Yankees in
sure.
their heyday. So I assume you were not that. You were something else.
Well, you know, I went to an Ivy League school, which is typically not a hotbed for, you know, world-class track and field. 4 years before the Olympic Games, I had thrown the high school shot 54 feet, and there was a fellow from Texas who had set the national record of 81 feet, so I was 27 feet behind him. At the Olympic trials 4 years later, I beat him. Hmm. So I can get this done. You know, I know I'm not a stranger to hard work. I'm not a stranger to being an underdog, and I have prevailed. And I know in this climate, with the right team behind me, with the right support in the state, I can win this race.
So when you're an underdog, typically you have to think about a different set of strategies than whatever the conventional strategy is. So we go back to the American Revolution. I mean, certainly our mythology anyway tells us, well, the British were better trained, the British were better equipped, better armed. They could hire mercenaries to make up any numerical deficits that they felt they had. They could get some Hessians. And so the colonial effort had to be less conventional, had to have a little bit more of an improvised or a guerrilla feel. So is that how you feel running as a Republican opponent to Dick Blumenthal, that you have to kind of live off the land a little bit?
Sure. There's a great element to that, and I believe that we are going to assemble one of the best ground game teams in Connecticut political history over the next 9 months. But I also would just highlight the fact that 6-9 months ago, not one political expert would say that Donald Trump had a chance of doing what he's done. Times have changed. It's social media changed things. It's just that the mood of the populace has changed. This is going to be a wild year for politics. And to simply say that Dick Blumenthal is not beatable because of his past performance and his I would say, very questionable approval ratings, I think is wrong.
I saw the other day that I think in Torrington, you were really guest teaching a CrossFit class. Is that kind of an underdog candidate thing to do?
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm all about activity. I think sport is one of the best things in society, and not watching sport, but doing sport. And we're going to do a lot of things that involve people doing sport. And sport teaches lessons to people about life, and a lot of kids don't learn that now in our society because they've got devices in their hands, or they're not able to be on the varsity team, so they just stop doing sport. And that's wrong.
All right. Well, August Wolf, I'm sure we'll be talking more and more as the campaign rolls along. It should be an interesting campaign, but a tough one, an uphill fight. I have like about 30 seconds. I just want to say the greatest underdog thing I've ever seen in my life was in 1970 when Bob Lanier of the St. Bonaventure basketball team got hurt. He was the big cat. He was this big guy. And his team was in the semifinals of the NCAAs. It was March Madness back then. And the next tallest guy on the team was 6'5", who was like a sub or something. And they had to play Jacksonville with Artis Gilmore, who was 7'2", Pembroke Burroughs, who was 7 feet tall, and Tom McIntyre, who was 6'10". And they made it close. They didn't win, but they made it close. I've never rooted for an underdog. I mean, I was a kid. I cried when they lost because they were so gutsy and so courageous. Thanks to my gutsy, courageous team for getting this show together.
If I ran against August Wolf, then who would be the underdog?
What do you mean?
Well, who would be most likely to lose?
The people of Connecticut.
Ooh, burn.